Clinton doubts that super smart robots will continue to listen to us. That is like asking if a child can control his parents. There is not a good track record of less intelligent things controlling things of greater intelligence. Oxford professor Nick Bostrom has stated that before the prospect of an intelligence explosion, we humans are like small children playing with a bomb. We have little idea when the detonation will occur, though if we hold the device to our ear, we can hear a faint ticking sound. Others hold that a robot uprising would be a case of evolution taking its course. The fittest replace organisms that are weaker. This is the natural order of things. Some computer scientists actually welcome the day when robots will outstrip humans cognitively. Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, once declared, "I visualize a time when we will be to robots what dogs are to humans, and I'm rooting for the machines." Of the many AI researchers I have interviewed over the years, all of them were confident that AI machines would one day approach human intelligence and be of great service to humanity. However, many of them refrained from offering specific dates or timelines for this advancement. Professor Marvin Minsky of MIT, who wrote some of the founding papers on artificial intelligence, made optimistic predictions in the 1950s, but disclosed to me in a recent interview that he is no longer willing to predict specific dates. Because AI researchers have been wrong too often in the past, Edward Feigenbaum of Stanford University maintains, "It is ridiculous to talk about such things so early. AI is eons away." A computer scientist quoted in The New Yorker said, "I don't worry about that machine intelligence for the same reason I don't worry about overpopulation on Mars." When addressing the Zuckerberg-Musk controversy, my own personal viewpoint is that Zuckerberg, in the short term, is correct. AI will not only make possible cities in outer space, it will also enrich society by making things more efficient, better, and cheaper, while creating an entirely new set of jobs generated by the robotics industry, which may one day be larger than the automobile industry of today. But in the long term, Musk is correct to point out a larger risk. The key question in this debate is, at what point will robots make this transition and become dangerous? I personally think the key turning point is precisely when robots become self-aware. Today, robots do not know they are robots. But one day, they might have the ability to create their own goals, rather than adopt the goals chosen by their programmers. Then they might realize that their agenda is different from ours. Once our interests diverge, robots could pose a danger. When might this happen? No one knows. Today, robots have the intelligence of a bug. But perhaps by late in this century, they might become self-aware. By then, we will also have rapidly growing permanent settlements on Mars. Therefore, it is important that we address this question now, rather than when we have become dependent on them for our very survival on the Red Planet. To gain some insight into the scope of this critical issue, it may be helpful to examine the best and worst-case scenarios. Best-case and worst-case scenarios. A proponent of the best-case scenario is inventor and best-selling author Ray Kurzweil. Each time I have interviewed him, he has described a clear and compelling but controversial vision of the future. He believes that by 2045, we will reach the singularity, or the point at which robots match or surpass human intelligence. The term comes from the concept of a gravitational singularity in physics, which refers to regions of infinite gravity, such as in a black hole. It was introduced into computer science by mathematician John von Neumann, who wrote that the computer revolution would create an ever-accelerating progress and changes in the mode of human life, which gives the appearance of approaching some essential singularity, beyond which human affairs as we know them could not continue. Kurzweil claims that when the singularity arrives, a $1,000 computer will be a billion times more intelligent than all humans combined. Moreover, these robots would be self-improving, and their progeny would inherit their acquired characteristics, so that each generation would be superior to the previous one, leading to an ascending spiral of high-functioning machines. Kurzweil maintains that, instead of taking over, our robot creations will unlock a new world of health and prosperity. According to him, microscopic robots, or nanobots, will circulate in our blood and destroy pathogens, correct DNA errors, eliminate toxins, and perform many other tasks to enhance our physical well-being. He is hopeful that science will soon discover a cure for aging, and firmly believes that if he lives long enough, he will live forever. He confided to me that he takes several hundred pills a day, anticipating his own immortality. But in case he doesn't make it, he has willed his body to be preserved in liquid nitrogen at a cryogenics firm. Kurzweil also foresees a time much further into the future when robots will convert the atoms of the Earth into computers. Eventually, all the atoms of the Sun and solar system would be absorbed into this grand thinking machine. He told me that when he gazes into the heavens, he sometimes imagines that he might, in due course, witness evidence of super-intelligent robots rearranging the stars. Not everyone is convinced, however, of this rosy future. Mitch Kapoor, founder of Lotus Development Corporation, says that the singularity movement is fundamentally, in my view, driven by a religious impulse, and all the frantic arm-waving can't obscure that fact for me. Hollywood has countered Kurzweil's utopia with a worst-case scenario for what it might mean to create our own evolutionary successors, who might push us aside and make us go the way of the dodo bird. In the movie The Terminator, the military creates an intelligent computer network called Skynet, which monitors all of our nuclear weapons. It is designed to protect us from the threat of nuclear war. But then Skynet becomes self-aware. The military, frightened that the machine has developed a mind of its own, tries to shut it down. Skynet, programmed to protect itself, does the only thing it can do to prevent this, and that is to destroy the human race. It proceeds to launch a devastating nuclear war, wiping out civilization. Humans are reduced to raggedy bands of misfits and gorillas trying to defeat the awesome power of the machines. Is Hollywood just trying to sell tickets by scaring the pants off moviegoers? Or could this really happen? This question is thorny in part because the concepts of self-awareness and consciousness are so clouded by moral, philosophical, and religious arguments that we lack a rigorous conventional framework in which to understand them. Before we continue our discussion of machine intelligence, we need to establish a clear definition of self-awareness. Space-time theory of consciousness. I have proposed a theory that I call the space-time theory of consciousness. It is testable, reproducible, falsifiable, and quantifiable. It not only defines self-awareness, but also allows us to quantify it on a scale. The theory starts with the idea that animals, plants, and even machines can be conscious. Consciousness, I claim, is the process of creating a model of yourself using multiple feedback loops. For example, in space, in society, or in time, in order to carry out a goal. To measure consciousness, we simply count the number and types of feedback loops necessary for subjects to achieve a model of themselves. The smallest unit of consciousness might be found in a thermostat or photocell, which employs a single feedback loop to create a model of itself in terms of temperature or light. A flower might have, say, 10 units of consciousness, since it has 10 feedback loops measuring water, temperature, the direction of gravity, sunlight, etc. In my theory, these loops can be grouped according to a certain level of consciousness. Thermostats and flowers would belong to level 0. Level 1 consciousness includes that of reptiles, fruit flies, and mosquitoes, which generate models of themselves with regard to space. A reptile has numerous feedback loops to determine the coordinates of its prey and the location of potential mates, potential rivals, and itself. Level 2 involves social animals. Their feedback loops relate to their pack or tribe and produce models of the complex social hierarchy within the group as expressed by emotions and gestures. These levels roughly mimic the stages of evolution of the mammalian brain. The most ancient part of our brain is at the very back, where balance, territoriality, and instincts are processed. The brain expanded in the forward direction and developed the limbic system, the monkey brain of emotions, located in the center of the brain. This progression from the back to the front is also the way a child's brain matures. So then, what is human consciousness in this scheme? What distinguishes us from plants and animals? I theorize that humans are different from animals because we understand time. We have temporal consciousness, in addition to spatial and social consciousness. The latest part of the brain to evolve is the prefrontal cortex, which lies just behind our forehead. It is constantly running simulations of the future. Animals may seem like they're planning, for example, when they hibernate, but these behaviors are largely the result of instinct. It is not possible to teach your pet dog or cat the meaning of tomorrow because they live in the present. Humans, however, are constantly preparing for the future, and even for beyond our own lifespans. We scheme and daydream. We can't help it. Our brains are planning machines. MRI scans have shown that when we arrange to perform a task, we access and incorporate previous memories of that same task, which make our plans more realistic. One theory states that animals don't have a sophisticated memory system because they rely on instinct and therefore don't require the ability to envision the future. In other words, the very purpose of having a memory may be to project it into the future. Within this framework, we can now define self-awareness, which can be understood as the ability to put ourselves inside a simulation of the future, consistent with a goal. When we apply this theory to machines, we see that our best machines at present are on the lowest rung of level 1 consciousness, based on their ability to locate their position in space. Most, like those built for the DARPA Robotics Challenge, can barely navigate around an empty room. There are some robots that can partially simulate the future, such as Google's DeepMind computer, but only in an extremely narrow direction. If you ask DeepMind to accomplish anything other than a Go game, it freezes up. How much further do we have to go, and what are the steps we will have to take to achieve a self-aware machine like the Terminator Skynet? Creating self-aware machines? In order to create self-aware machines, we would have to give them an objective. Goals do not magically arise in robots, and instead must be programmed into them from the outside. This condition is a tremendous barrier against machine rebellion. Take the 1921 play RUR, which first coined the word robot. Its plot describes robots rising up against humans because they see other robots being mistreated. For this to happen, the machines would need to have a high level of pre-programming. Robots do not feel empathy or suffering or desire to take over the world unless they are instructed to do so. But let us say, for the sake of argument, that someone gives our robot the aim of eliminating humanity. The computer must then create realistic simulations of the future and place itself in these plans. We now come up against the crucial problem. To be able to list possible scenarios and outcomes and evaluate how realistic they are, the robot would have to understand millions of rules of common sense, the simple laws of physics, biology, and human behavior that we take for granted. Moreover, it would have to understand causality and anticipate the consequences of certain actions. Humans learn these laws from decades of experiences. One reason why childhood lasts so long is because there is so much subtle information to absorb about human society and the natural world. Robots, however, have not been exposed to the great majority of interactions that draw upon shared experience. I like to think of the case of an experienced bank robber who can plan his next heist efficiently and outsmart the police because he has a large storehouse of memories of previous bank robberies and can understand the effect of each decision he makes. In contrast, to accomplish a simple action such as bringing a gun into a bank to rob it, a computer would have to analyze a complex sequence of secondary events numbering in the thousands, each one involving millions of lines of computer code. It would not intrinsically grasp cause and effect. It is certainly possible for robots to become self-aware and to have dangerous goals. But you can see why it is so unlikely, especially in the foreseeable future. Inputting all the equations that a machine would need to destroy the human race would be an immensely difficult undertaking. The problem of killer robots can largely be eliminated by preventing anyone from programming them to have objectives harmful to humans. When self-aware robots do arrive, we must add a fail-safe chip that will shut them off if they have murderous thoughts. We can rest easy knowing that we will not be placed in zoos anytime soon, where our robot successors can throw peanuts at us through the bars and make us dance. This means that when we explore the outer planets and the stars, we can rely on robots to help us build the infrastructure necessary to create settlements and cities on distant moons and planets. But we have to be careful that their goals are consistent with ours and that we have fail-safe mechanisms in place in case they pose a threat. Though we may face danger when robots become self-aware, that won't happen until late in this century or early in the next, so there is time to prepare. Why robots run amok? There is one scenario, however, that keeps AI researchers up at night. A robot could conceivably be given an ambiguous or ill-phrased command that, if carried out, would unleash havoc. In the movie iRobot, there is a master computer called Vicky, which controls the infrastructure of the city. Vicky is given the command to protect humanity. But by studying how humans treat other humans, the computer comes to the conclusion that the greatest threat to humanity is humanity itself. It mathematically determines that the only way to protect humanity is to take control over it. Another example is the tale of King Midas. He asked the god Dionysus for the ability to turn anything into gold by touching it. This power at first seems to be a sure path to riches and glory. But then he touches his daughter, who turns to gold. His food, too, becomes inedible. He finds himself a slave of the very gift he begged for. H.G. Wells explored a similar predicament with his short story, The Man Who Could Work Miracles. One day, an ordinary clerk finds himself with an astonishing ability. Anything he wishes for comes true. He goes out drinking late at night with a friend, performing miracles along the way. They don't want the night to ever end, so he innocently wishes that the earth would stop rotating. All of a sudden, violent winds and gigantic floods descend upon them. People, buildings, and towns are hurled into space at 1,000 miles per hour, the speed of the Earth's rotation. Realizing that he has destroyed the planet, his last wish is for everything to return to normal, the way it was before he gained his power. Here, science fiction teaches us to exercise caution. As we develop AI, we must meticulously examine every possible consequence, especially those that may not be immediately obvious. After all, our ability to do so is part of what makes us human. Quantum computing. To gain a fuller picture of the future of robotics, let's take a closer look at what goes on inside computers. Currently, most digital computers are based on silicon circuits and obey Moore's law, which states that computer power doubles every 18 months. But technological advancement in the past few years has begun to slow down from its frantic pace in the previous decades, and some have posited an extreme scenario in which Moore's law collapses and seriously disrupts the world economy, which has come to depend on the nearly exponential growth of computing power. If this happens, Silicon Valley could turn into another rust belt. To head off this potential crisis, physicists around the world are seeking a replacement for silicon. They are working on an assortment of alternative computers, including molecular, atomic, DNA, quantum dot, optical, and protein computers. But none of them are ready for prime time. There is also a wild card in the mix. As silicon transistors become smaller and smaller, they will reach the size of atoms. Currently, a standard Pentium chip may have silicon layers with a thickness of 20 atoms or so. Within a decade, these chips may have layers only 5 atoms deep, and if so, electrons may begin to leak out, as predicted by quantum theory, creating short circuits. A revolutionary type of computer is necessary. Molecular computers, perhaps based on graphene, may replace silicon chips. But one day, perhaps even these molecular computers will encounter problems with effects predicted by quantum theory. At that point, we may have to build the ultimate computer, the quantum computer, capable of operating on the smallest transistor possible, a single atom. Here's how it might work. Silicon circuits contain a gate that can either be open or closed to the flow of electrons. Information is stored on the basis of these open or closed circuits. Binary mathematics, which is based on a series of ones and zeros, describes this process. Zero may represent a closed gate, and one may represent an open gate. Now consider replacing silicon with a row of individual atoms. Atoms are like tiny magnets, which have a north pole and a south pole. When atoms are placed in a magnetic field, you might suspect that they can be pointing either up or down. In reality, each atom actually points up and down simultaneously until a final measurement is made. In a sense, an electron can be in two states at the same time. This defies common sense, but is the reality according to quantum mechanics. Its advantage is enormous. You can only store so much data if the magnets are pointing up or down. But if each magnet is a mixture of states, you can pack far greater amounts of information onto a tiny cluster of atoms. Each bit of information, which can be either one or zero, now becomes a qubit, a complex mixture of ones and zeros with vastly more storage. The point of bringing up quantum computers is that they may hold the key to exploring the universe. In principle, a quantum computer may give us the ability to exceed human intelligence. They are still a wild card. We don't know when quantum computers will arrive or what their full potential may be, but they could prove invaluable in space exploration. Rather than simply build the settlements and cities of the future, they may take us a step further and give us the ability to do the high-level planning necessary to terraform entire planets. Quantum computers would be vastly more potent than ordinary digital computers. Digital computers might need several centuries to crack a code based on an exceptionally difficult math problem, such as factorizing a number in the millions into two smaller numbers. But quantum computers, calculating with a high number of mixed atomic states, could swiftly complete the decryption. The CIA and other spy agencies are acutely aware of their promise. Among the mountains of classified material from the National Security Agency that were leaked to the press a few years ago was a top-secret document indicating that quantum computers were being carefully monitored by the agency, but that no breakthrough was expected in the immediate future. Given the excitement and hubbub over quantum computers, when might we expect to have them? Why don't we have quantum computers? Computing on individual atoms can be both a blessing and a curse. While atoms can store an enormous quantity of information, the most minute impurity, vibration, or disturbance could ruin a calculation. It is necessary, but notoriously difficult, to totally isolate the atoms from the outside world. They must reach a state of what is called coherence, in which they vibrate in unison. But the slightest interference, say someone sneezing in the next building, could cause the atoms to vibrate randomly and independently of one another. Decoherence is one of the biggest problems we face in the development of quantum computers. Because of this problem, quantum computers today can only perform rudimentary calculations. In fact, the world record for a quantum computer involves about 20 qubits. This may not seem so impressive, but it is truly an achievement. It may take several decades, or perhaps until late in this century, to attain a high-functioning quantum computer. But when the technology arrives, it will dramatically augment the power of AI. Robots in the far future. Considering the primitive state of automatons today, I also would not expect to see self-aware robots for a number of decades. Again, perhaps not until the end of the century. In the intervening years, we will likely first deploy sophisticated remote-controlled machines to continue the work of exploring space, and then perhaps automatons with innovative learning capabilities to begin laying the foundations for human settlements. Later will come self-replicating automatons to complete infrastructure, and then finally, quantum-fueled conscious machines to help us establish and maintain an intergalactic civilization. Of course, all this talk of reaching distant stars raises an important question. How are we, or our robots, supposed to get there? How accurate are the starships we see every night on TV? Why go to the stars? Because we are the descendants of those primates who chose to look over the next hill. Because we won't survive here indefinitely. Because the stars are there, beckoning with fresh horizons. James and Gregory Benford. Chapter 8. Building a Starship. In the movie Passengers, the Avalon, a state-of-the-art starship powered by massive fusion engines, is traveling to Homestead 2, a colony on a distant planet. The ads for this settlement are alluring. The Earth is old, tired, overpopulated, and polluted. Why not make a fresh start in an exciting world? The journey takes 120 years, during which passengers are placed in suspended animation, their bodies frozen in pods. When the Avalon reaches its destination, the ship will automatically awaken its 5,000 riders. They will arise from their pods feeling refreshed and ready to build a new life in a new home. However, during the trip, a meteor storm punctures the ship's hull and damages its fusion engines, causing a cascade of malfunctions. One of the passengers is revived prematurely, with 90 years left to go in the voyage. He becomes lonely and depressed by the thought that the ship will not land until long after he is dead. Desperate for companionship, he decides to wake up a beautiful fellow traveler. Naturally, they fall in love. But when she finds out that he deliberately roused her almost a century too soon, and that she, too, will die in interplanetary purgatory, she goes ballistic. Movies like Passengers embody recent attempts by Hollywood to inject a little realism into its science fiction. The Avalon makes its trip the old-fashioned way, never exceeding the speed of light. But ask any kid to imagine a starship, and he or she will come up with something like the Enterprise from Star Trek, or the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars, capable of whisking crews across the galaxy at a faster-than-light clip, and perhaps even tunneling through space-time and zapping across hyperspace. Realistically, our first starships may not be manned and may not resemble any of the huge, sleek vehicles dreamed up in films. In fact, they may be no bigger than a postage stamp. In 2016, my colleague Stephen Hawking startled the world by backing a project called Breakthrough Starshot, which seeks to develop nanoships, sophisticated chips placed on sails, energized by a huge bank of powerful laser beams on Earth. The chips would each be the size of your thumb, weigh less than an ounce, and contain billions of transistors. One of the most promising aspects of the endeavor is that we can use existing technology to make it happen, instead of having to wait 100 or 200 years. Hawking claimed that nanoships could be developed for $10 billion in the span of one generation, and, using 100 billion watts of laser power, would be able to travel at one-fifth the speed of light to reach the Centauri system, the nearest star system, in 20 years. By contrast, remember that each space shuttle mission remained in near-Earth orbit but cost almost $1 billion per launch. Nanoships would be able to accomplish what chemical rockets never can. Tsiolkovsky's rocket equation shows that it is impossible for a conventional Saturn rocket to reach the nearest star, since it would need exponentially more fuel the faster it went, and a chemical rocket simply cannot carry enough fuel for a journey of such length. Assuming it could reach the nearby stars, the trip would take about 70,000 years. Most of the energy of a chemical rocket goes into lifting its own weight into space. But a nanoship passively receives its energy from external ground-based lasers, so there is no wasted fuel. 100% of it goes into propelling the ship. And since nanoships do not have to generate their own energy, they have no moving parts. This significantly reduces the chances of mechanical breakdowns. They also have no explosive chemicals and would not blow up on the launch pad or in space. Computer technology has advanced to the stage where we can pack an entire scientific laboratory into a chip. Nanoships would contain cameras, sensors, chemical kits, and solar cells, all designed to make detailed analyses of faraway planets and radio information back to Earth. Because the cost of computer chips has dropped dramatically, we could send thousands of them to the stars in the hope that a few of them might survive the hazardous journey. The strategy mimics that of Mother Nature, in which plants scatter thousands of tiny seeds to the winds to boost the odds that some will succeed. A nanoship whizzing by the Centauri system at 20% of the speed of light would have just a few hours to complete its mission. In that time frame, it would locate Earth-like planets and rapidly photograph and analyze them to determine their surface characteristics, temperatures, and the composition of their atmospheres. In particular, looking for the presence of water or oxygen. It would also scan the star system for radio emissions, which might indicate the existence of alien intelligence. Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, has publicly supported Breakthrough Starshot, and Russian investor and former physicist Yuri Milner has personally pledged $100 million. Nanoships are already much more than an idea, but there are several obstacles we must reckon with before we can fully execute the project. Problems with laser sails. To send a fleet of nanoships to Alpha Centauri, a laser bank would have to fire a barrage of beams totaling at least 100 gigawatts at the parachutes of the ships for about 2 minutes. The light pressure from these laser beams would send the ships darting into space. The beams must be aimed with astonishing precision to ensure that the ships hit their target. The slightest deviation in their trajectory would compromise the mission. The main hurdle we face is not the basic science, which is already available, but funding, even with several high-profile scientists and entrepreneurs on board. Each nuclear power plant costs several billion dollars and can generate only 1 gigawatt, or 1 billion watts of power. The process of soliciting federal and private financing for a sufficiently powerful and accurate laser bank is causing a severe bottleneck. As a practice run before aiming for distant stars, scientists may decide to send nanoships to closer destinations within the solar system. It would take them only 5 seconds to zip to the moon, about an hour and a half to get to Mars, and a few days to reach Pluto. Rather than waiting 10 years for a mission to the outer planets, we could receive new information about them from nanoships in a matter of days. And in this way, we could observe the developments in the solar system very nearly in real time. In a subsequent phase of the project, we might attempt to set up a battery of laser cannons on the moon. When a laser passes through the Earth's atmosphere, about 60% of its energy is lost. A lunar launch facility would help to remedy this problem, and solar panels on the moon could provide cheap and plentiful electrical energy to fuel the laser beams. Recall that one lunar day is equivalent to about 30 Earth days, so the energy could be efficiently collected and stored in batteries. This system would save us billions of dollars, because unlike nuclear power, sunlight is free. By the early 22nd century, the technology for self-replicating robots should be perfected, and we may be able to entrust machines with the task of constructing solar arrays and laser batteries on the moon, Mars, and beyond. We would ship over an initial team of automatons, some of which would mine the regolith, and others of which would build a factory. Another set of robots would oversee the sorting, milling, and smelting of raw materials in the factory to separate and obtain various metals. These purified metals could then be used to assemble laser launch stations and a new batch of self-replicating robots. We might eventually have a bustling network of relay stations throughout the solar system, perhaps stretching from the moon all the way to the Oort cloud. Because the comets in the Oort cloud extend roughly halfway to Alpha Centauri and are largely stationary, they may be ideal locations for laser banks that could provide an extra boost to nanoships on their journey to our neighboring star system. As each nanoship passed by one of these relay stations, its lasers would fire automatically and give the ship an added push to the stars. Self-replicating robots could build these distant outposts by using fusion instead of sunlight as the basic source of energy. Light sails. Laser-propelled nanoships are just one type in a much larger category of starships called light sails. Just as sailboats capture the force of the wind, light sails harness the light pressure from sunlight or lasers. In fact, many of the equations used to guide sailboats can also be applied to light sails in outer space. Light is made up of particles called photons, and when photons strike an object, they do exert a minuscule pressure. Because light pressure is so small, scientists were not aware of its existence for a long time. It was Johannes Kepler who first noticed the effect when he realized that, contrary to expectations, comet tails always point away from the sun. Kepler correctly surmised that pressure from sunlight creates these tails by blowing dust and ice crystals in comets away from the sun. The prescient Jules Verne anticipated light sails in From the Earth to the Moon when he wrote, "There will someday appear velocities far greater than these, of which light or electricity will probably be the mechanical agent. We shall one day travel to the moon, the planets, and the stars." Tsiolkovsky further developed the concept of solar sails, or spaceships that utilize light pressure from the sun. But the history of solar sails has been spotty. NASA has not made them a priority. The Planetary Society's Cosmos 1 in 2005 and NASA's NanoSail D in 2008 both suffered launch failures. They were followed by NASA's NanoSail D2, which entered low Earth orbit in 2010. The only successful attempt to send a solar sail past Earth orbit was accomplished by the Japanese in 2010. The Icarus satellite deployed a sail that was 46 feet by 46 feet in size and was powered by solar light pressure. It reached Venus in 6 months, thereby proving that solar sails were feasible. The idea continues to percolate despite its erratic progress. The European Space Agency is considering launching the Gossamer Solar Sail, whose purpose would be to deorbit some of the thousands of pieces of space junk littering the area around Earth. I recently interviewed Jeffrey Landis, an MIT-educated NASA scientist working on the Mars program as well as on light sails. Both he and his wife, Mary Terzio, are award-winning science fiction novelists. I asked him how he managed to bridge such different worlds, one populated by meticulous scientists and their complex equations, the other filled with space groupies and UFO buffs. He responded that science fiction was wonderful because it allowed him to speculate far into the future. Physics, he said, kept him grounded. Landis's specialization is the light sail. He has proposed a starship for the journey to Alpha Centauri that would consist of a light sail made of an ultra-thin layer of a diamond-like material several hundred miles across. The ship would be gigantic, weighing 1 million tons, and would require resources from across the solar system to build and operate, including energy from laser banks near Mercury. To be able to stop at its destination, the ship would contain a large magnetic parachute, with the field produced by a loop of wire 60 miles in diameter. Hydrogen atoms from space would pass through the loop and generate friction, which would gradually slow down the light sail over several decades. A round trip to Alpha Centauri and back would take 2 centuries, so the crew would have to be multi-generational. Although this starship is physically achievable, it would be costly, and Landis conceded that it might take 50 to 100 years to actually assemble and test. In the meantime, he is helping to build the breakthrough Starshot laser sail. Ion engines. In addition to laser propulsion and solar sails, there are a number of other potential ways to energize a starship. To compare them, it is useful to introduce a concept called specific impulse, which is the thrust of the rocket multiplied by the time over which the rocket fires. Specific impulse is measured in units of seconds. The longer a rocket fires its engines, the larger its specific impulse, from which its final velocity can be calculated. Here is a simple chart that ranks the specific impulse of several types of rockets. I have not included some designs, like the laser rocket, solar sail, and ramjet fusion rocket, that technically have a specific impulse of infinity, since their engines can be fired indefinitely. Rocket engine, solid fuel rocket, specific impulse, 250. Liquid fuel rocket, 450. Nuclear fission rocket, 800 to 1,000. Ion engine, 5,000. Plasma engine, 1,000 to 30,000. Nuclear fusion rocket, 2,500 to 200,000. Nuclear pulsed rocket, 10,000 to 1 million. Antimatter rocket, 1 million to 10 million. Notice that chemical rockets, which burn for only a few minutes, have the lowest specific impulse. Next on the list are the ion engines, which may be useful for missions to nearby planets. Ion engines start by taking a gas like xenon, stripping the electrons off its atoms to turn them into ions, charged fragments of atoms, and then accelerating these ions with an electric field. The inside of an ion engine bears some resemblance to the inside of a TV monitor, where electric and magnetic fields guide a beam of electrons. The thrust of ion engines is so excruciatingly small, often measured in ounces, that when you turn one on in the lab, nothing seems to happen. But once in space, over time they can attain velocities exceeding chemical rockets. Ion engines have been compared to the tortoise in the race with the hare, which in this case would be chemical rockets. Although the hare can sprint with enormous speed, it can only do so for a few minutes before it is exhausted. The tortoise, on the other hand, is slower but can walk for days, and thus wins long-distance competitions. Ion rockets can operate for years at a time, and hence have considerably larger specific impulses than chemical rockets. To increase the power of an ion engine, one might ionize the gas using microwaves or radio waves, and then use magnetic fields to accelerate the ions. This is called a plasma engine, which, in theory, could cut the travel time to Mars from 9 months to fewer than 40 days, according to its proponents. But the technology is still in development. One limiting factor to plasma engines is the large amount of electricity necessary to create the plasma, which may even require a nuclear power plant for interplanetary missions. NASA has studied and built ion engines for decades. For example, the Deep Space Transport, which may take our astronauts to Mars in the 2030s, uses ion propulsion. Late in this century, ion engines will most likely become the backbone of interplanetary space missions. Although chemical rockets might still be the best option for time-sensitive missions, ion engines would be a solid, dependable choice when time is not the most important consideration. Beyond the ion engine on the specific impulse chart, are propulsion systems that are more speculative. We will discuss each of them in the following pages.
100-Year Starship. In 2011, DARPA and NASA funded a symposium entitled The 100-Year Starship. It generated considerable interest. The aim was not to build an actual starship within 100 years, but to assemble top scientific minds who could lay out a feasible agenda for interstellar travel for the next century. The project was organized by members of the Old Guard, an informal group of elderly physicists and engineers, many now in their 70s, who seek to draw upon their collective knowledge to take us to the stars. They have passionately kept the flame alive for decades. Landis is a member of the Old Guard, but there is also an unusual pair among them, James and Gregory Benford, twins who happen to both be physicists as well as science fiction writers. James told me that his fascination with starships began when he was a child, devouring all the science fiction he could get his hands on, especially Robert Heinlein's old Space Cadet series. He realized that if he and his brother were serious about space, they would have to learn physics, lots of it. So both set off to get their PhDs in the field. James is now the president of Microwave Sciences and has worked for many decades with high-powered microwave systems. Gregory is a professor of physics at the University of California, Irvine, and in his other life has won the coveted Nebula Award for one of his novels. In the wake of the 100-Year Starship Symposium, James and Gregory wrote a book, Starship Century, Toward the Grandest Horizon, containing many of the ideas presented there. James, an expert on microwave radiation, believes that light sails are our best chance of travel beyond the solar system. But, he said, there is a long history of alternate theoretical designs that would be exceedingly expensive, but are based on solid physics and might one day actually happen. Nuclear rockets. This history goes back to the 1950s, an era when most people lived in terror of nuclear war, but a few atomic scientists were looking for peaceful applications for nuclear energy. They considered all sorts of ideas, such as deploying nuclear weapons to carve out ports and harbors. Most of these suggestions were rejected due to concerns about the fallout and disruption from nuclear explosions. One intriguing proposal that lingered, however, was called Project Orion, and it sought to use nuclear bombs as the power source for starships. The skeleton of the plan was simple. Create mini atomic bombs and eject them one by one from the back end of a starship. Each time a mini nuke exploded, it would create a shockwave of energy that would push the starship forward. In principle, if a series of mini nukes were released in succession, the rocket could accelerate to nearly the speed of light.
The idea was developed by nuclear physicist Ted Taylor, along with Freeman Dyson. Taylor was famous for designing a wide variety of nuclear bombs. From the largest fission bomb ever detonated, with a force of about 25 times the Hiroshima bomb, down to the little Davy Crockett portable nuclear cannon, with a force 1,000 times smaller than the Hiroshima bomb. But he longed to channel his extensive knowledge of nuclear explosives toward peaceful purposes. He jumped at the opportunity to pioneer the Orion starship. The main challenge was figuring out how to carefully control the sequence of small detonations so that the starship could safely ride the wave of nuclear blasts without being destroyed in the process. Different designs for a range of speeds were drawn up. The largest model would be a quarter of a mile in diameter, would weigh 8 million metric tons, and would be propelled by 1,080 bombs. On paper, it could attain a velocity of 10% of the speed of light and reach Alpha Centauri in 40 years. Despite the immense size of this ship, calculations showed that it might just work. Critics converged on the idea, however, pointing out that nuclear pulse starships would unleash radioactive fallout. Taylor countered that fallout is created when dirt and the metallic bomb casing become radioactive after the bomb is set off, so it could be avoided if the starship only fired its engine in outer space. But the Test Ban Treaty of 1963 also made it difficult to experiment with miniature atomic bombs. The Orion starship ultimately wound up as a curiosity, relegated to old science books. Drawbacks to nuclear rockets. Another reason the project came to a close was that Ted Taylor himself lost interest. I once asked him why he withdrew his support for the effort, since it seemed like a natural use for his talent. He explained to me that to create the Orion would be to produce a new type of nuclear bomb. Although he spent most of his life designing uranium fission bombs, he realized that one day the Orion spacecraft might use powerful specially designed H-bombs as well. These bombs, which release the greatest amount of energy known to science, have gone through three stages of development. The first H-bombs of the 1950s were gigantic devices that required large ships to transport them. For all practical purposes, they would have been useless in a nuclear war. Second-generation nuclear bombs are the small portable MIRVs, or multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, that make up the backbone of the U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals. You can pack 10 of them into the nose cone of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Third-generation nuclear bombs, sometimes called designer nuclear bombs, are, at the moment, still a concept. They could be easily concealed and custom-made for specific battlefields, for example, the desert, the forest, the Arctic, or outer space. Taylor told me that he had become disillusioned with the project and feared that terrorists could get hold of them. It would be an unspeakable nightmare for him if his bombs fell into the wrong hands and destroyed an American city. He reflected candidly on the irony of his about-face. He had contributed to a field in which scientists would put pins, each representing a nuclear bomb, in a map of Moscow. But when faced with the possibility that third-generation weapons could put pins in an American city, he suddenly decided to oppose the development of advanced nuclear weapons. James Benford informed me that although Taylor's nuclear pulse rocket never made it off the drawing board, the government actually did produce a series of nuclear rockets. Instead of exploding mini-atomic bombs, these rockets used an old-fashioned uranium reactor to generate the necessary heat. The reactor was used to heat up a liquid, such as liquid hydrogen, to a high temperature, and then shoot it out a nozzle in the back, creating thrust. Several versions were built and tested in the desert. These reactors were quite radioactive, and there was always the danger of a meltdown during the launch phase, which would have been disastrous. Due to an assortment of technical problems, as well as growing anti-nuclear sentiment among the public, these nuclear rockets were mothballed. Fusion rockets. The scheme to employ nuclear bombs to propel starships died in the 1960s. But in the wings was another possibility. In 1978, the British Interplanetary Society initiated Project Daedalus. Instead of using uranium fission bombs, Daedalus would use mini H-bombs, which Taylor himself looked at but never developed. The mini H-bombs of Daedalus are actually small second-generation bombs, not the true third-generation bombs that Taylor had so feared. There are several ways in which to release the power of fusion peacefully. One process, called magnetic confinement, involves placing hydrogen gas in a large magnetic field the shape of a donut, and then heating it up to millions of degrees. Hydrogen nuclei smash into one another and are fused into helium nuclei, releasing bursts of nuclear energy. The fusion reactor can be used to heat up a liquid, which is then released through a nozzle, thereby propelling the rocket. The leading fusion reactor using magnetic confinement at present is called the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, ITER, located in southern France. It is a monstrous machine, 10 times bigger than its closest competitor. It weighs 5,110 tons, stands 37 feet tall, and 64 feet in diameter, and has cost more than $14 billion so far. It is expected to attain fusion by 2035 and ultimately produce 500 megawatts of heat energy, compared to 1,000 megawatts of electricity in a standard uranium nuclear power plant. It is hoped that it will be the first fusion reactor to generate more energy than it consumes. Despite a series of delays and cost overruns, physicists I have talked to are betting that the ITER reactor will make history. We will have our answer before too long. As Nobel laureate Pierre-Gilles Desjardins once said, "We say that we will put the sun into a box. The idea is pretty. The problem is, we don't know how to make the box." Another variation of the Daedalus rocket might be fueled by laser fusion, in which giant laser beams compress a pellet of hydrogen-rich material. This process is called inertial confinement. The National Ignition Facility, NIF, based at the Livermore National Laboratory in California, exemplifies this process. Its battery of laser beams, 192 gigantic beams in 4,900-foot-long tubes, is the largest in the world. When the laser beams are focused on a tiny sample of hydrogen-rich lithium deuteride, their energy incinerates the surface of the material, resulting in a mini-explosion that causes the pellet to collapse and raises its temperature to 100 million degrees Celsius. This creates a fusion reaction that unleashes 500 trillion watts of power in a few trillionths of a second. I saw a demonstration of the NIF while hosting a Discovery Science Channel documentary. Visitors must first pass a series of national security checks, because the U.S. nuclear arsenal is designed at the Livermore Laboratory. When I finally entered, it was overwhelming. A 5-story apartment building could easily fit in the main chamber where the laser beams converge. One version of Project Daedalus exploits a process similar to laser fusion. Instead of a laser beam, it uses a large bank of electron beams to heat the hydrogen-rich pellet. If 250 pellets are detonated per second, enough energy could conceivably be generated for a starship to reach a fraction of the speed of light. However, this design would require a fusion rocket of truly immense size. One version of the Daedalus rocket would weigh 54,000 metric tons and would be about 625 feet long, with a maximum velocity of 12% of the speed of light. It is so big it would have to be constructed in outer space. The nuclear fusion rocket is conceptually sound, but fusion power has not yet been demonstrated. Furthermore, the sheer size and complexity of these projected rockets cast doubt on their feasibility, at least in this century. Still, alongside the light sail, the fusion rocket holds the most promise. Antimatter starships. Fifth wave technologies, which include antimatter engines, light sails, fusion engines, and nanoships, may open up exhilarating new horizons for starship design. Antimatter